So the series that we're going to be doing is, I'm calling it a preface to Matthew. So I've mentioned a number of times, we're going to get started here in a few weeks on a very detailed study going verse by verse through the text of Matthew. And so I'm excited about that. Hopefully you're at least a little bit excited about that. And Matthew is in so many ways a switchboard that connects the Old and the New Testaments. And so I'm really excited to be preaching through it. So I've been working on that the past few months, trying to get ready for it. But as one of the things we're going to do to prepare for it, I realized there were a number of topics I thought would be good to touch on that weren't really preaching topics. They were more teaching topics. And so I put together a five-part series entitled A Preface to Matthew. And so the five topics that we have are, number one, the fourfold gospel. We'll talk about that tonight. And so we actually won't be talking that much about Matthew tonight, but we'll be talking about this idea of the fourfold gospel. And then next week, we'll talk about the structure of Matthew. How is Matthew organized? And then the next week, we'll talk about the purpose of Matthew. What do we know about Matthew? What do we know about Matthew's audience? What do we know about some of the challenges they were facing in their day? The next week, we'll talk about the core. Well, it won't all be consecutive, but the five lessons. The fourth lesson will be the quarry of Matthew. So Matthew's use of the Old Testament and how that works. And then we'll talk about the textual transmission of Matthew in the last week in this Preface to Matthew series. So tonight, we're going to talk about the fourfold gospel. Most, if not all of us, are familiar with Paul's glorious summary of the gospel in 1 Corinthians 15. Moreover, brethren, I declare unto you the gospel which I preached unto you, which also ye have received, and wherein ye stand, by which also ye are saved, if ye keep in memory what I preached unto you, unless ye have believed in vain. For I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins, according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and he rose again the third day, according to the Scriptures. And though for the sake of time we'll stop our reading here, Paul goes on to give a full account of the witnesses to the resurrection, which is his focus, of course. The resurrection is his focus in 1 Corinthians 15. In Galatians, Paul makes it abundantly clear that there can be only one gospel. I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you, and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. As we said before, so now I say again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that ye have received, let him be accursed. Paul couldn't be any more clear. There is only one gospel of Jesus Christ. And yet when we open our Bibles, we find in our New Testament, there are no less than four Gospels. We have the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, the Gospel according to Luke, and the Gospel according to John. Now, sometimes in sort of conversation, we'll talk about the first Gospel, the Gospel according to Matthew, and we'll just say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or even the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, and the Gospel of John. And there's no great evil in that, but we have to understand that the titles of the Gospels, the Gospel according to Matthew and so on, those titles, the exact way in which they're formulated is very important. And the first thing to recognize about the Gospel titles is that if you look at the way the books were titled in the ancient world, and you look at the grammar and you look at the details of the gospel titles, it was a really unusual way of titling a book. The gospel according to someone. So it wasn't like there was this thing in the ancient world where they just called the book according to so-and-so. It's really, I don't know if it's absolutely unique to the gospels, but it's very, very unusual. It would have stood out to any first century reader. And not only was it an unusual title, these titles are very consistent. So sometimes later on in the manuscript tradition, you'll have things like, you know, the gospel according to the Holy Luke or something like that, where they'll add these sort of you know, the blessed theologian John, and they'll add descriptions. But the form of the gospel according to this individual is completely consistent. And not only is it completely consistent, but the names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the gospel according to them, is also consistent. And that tells us something. If those titles don't go back to very, very early, then we'd have a bunch of different titles and a bunch of different suggestions about who the authors were. The fact that they're so consistent across the entirety of the manuscript tradition tells us that even if they weren't, when Mark wrote his gospel, even if Mark didn't title it the gospel according to Mark, the first person who had Mark and Matthew, those titles were already there from the first time there were two gospels, even if they weren't in the very first gospel. And so they're very, very consistent, and it's an unusual form, and that turns out to be very significant because there is, in the way that that's formulated, it's very precise. There's one gospel according to four human witnesses, and so paying attention to the titles turns out to be significant. So how are we to understand this fourfold gospel? So if we say the gospel according to Matthew, the gospel according to Mark, the gospel according to Luke, the gospel according to John, that gives us a fourfold gospel. How do these four gospels relate both to one another and to the singular gospel of Jesus Christ? Why do we have four gospels in our New Testament instead of one or three or six or 20? And how are we supposed to read this fourfold gospel? Well, we'll only be able to scratch the surface on these questions tonight. It's essential that we at least scratch the surface before we start working verse by verse through the gospel according to Matthew. So over the next few minutes, we're going to talk about writing the fourfold gospel, so how the gospels were written, preserving the fourfold gospel, why we have four gospels and not some other number, and reading the fourfold gospel. So we're going to talk about writing, preserving, and reading. So we'll start by talking about writing the fourfold gospel. But before we do, are there any questions about the introduction? All right. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are often referred to as the synoptic gospels. So this comes from the Greek word synopsis, which means seeing together. And so we'll return to how they see together in a moment. So we'll talk about those synoptic gospels in a moment. So you have, when you look at the four gospels, you have Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then you have John. And John, rather than going over the same outline in a different way like Matthew, Mark, and Luke do, complements the others. Given the fact that John is basically telling the same story, he's clearly presenting the same Jesus, there is astonishingly little overlap between John and the synoptics. And since Matthew is one of the synoptic gospels, and I've already taught on John, we'll dig a little deeper into how the three synoptic gospels are related and what it means to say that Matthew, Mark, and Luke see together. And so the first point to be made about the synoptic gospels is that there is a literary relationship between the three synoptic gospels. What do I mean by a literary relationship? Well, let's break that down a little bit. So compared to John, the three synoptic gospels share a similar outline. So if you compare the synoptics to John, John tells the story of Jesus over the course of three Passovers. And so he basically gives a three-year structure to Jesus' ministry. And the synoptics organize Jesus' ministry around so it's not like they say he ministered for a year and he says he ministered for 3 years, but they have it all structured around a single visit to Jerusalem. And so the outline that they use to present the ministry of Jesus is a different basic structure than what John uses. Both are equally true, but they're coming from a different perspective. The three synoptics tell similar events and use similar language. So John's language, he has sort of his own vocabulary, and I've taught about that before. And more than that, there's a significant amount of overlap in the specific Greek words that the three use, and even in the order that those words are arranged. So you'll notice there are blocks of text in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that are all very, very close with very few differences. As Carson and Moo put it in their excellent introduction to the New Testament, only borrowing at the final literary level, literary being at the level of actually writing the gospel down, can explain the degree of similarity among the synoptic gospels. This solution to the relationship between the three gospels, the three synoptic gospels, has been urged from early in the history of the church and commands almost universal assent among contemporary New Testament scholars of all persuasions, with good reason. In other words, without yet making a claim as to which came first, the best explanation for the data we have is that one or more of the synoptic gospels, one or more of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, made direct use of one or more of the others as they were writing. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, one or more of those had one or more of the others in front of them as they were writing and incorporated portions of that into their own gospel. For a parallel to this in the Old Testament, it's abundantly clear that the writers of Chronicles, under the inspiration of the Spirit, incorporate portions of Samuel and Kings into their own works. So we see this at work in the Old Testament. When the Chronicles is written after Kings, when Chronicles is written, they include large sections of Kings and Samuel into their work, even though they're writing from a different angle to communicate a different message. They're telling the same story, and they write with those who had gone on before them in view. While the overwhelming majority of those who have considered the question agree that there is such a relationship between the synoptic gospels, there has been plenty of disagreement as to how they are related. So if we say one or more of them used one or more of the others, that's pretty clear. The evidence for that is very, very strong. But the question as to how these three gospels are related, which gospel writers used which other gospel writers, has often been referred to as the synoptic problem. Now, given the varying ways in which the word problem can be used, perhaps the synoptic question, which was the original sense of the word problem when that phrase was sort of developed, or even the synoptic puzzle, would be a better way to refer to the discussion. So it's a bit of a puzzle. It's pretty clear one or more of them used one or more of the others, but putting the order together, they didn't sort of use footnotes in the first century. That wasn't a thing. And so they didn't say, I used, you know, this other gospel. And so figuring out how they're related requires a little bit of detective work. So, any questions about the literary relationship between the synoptic gospels? Okay, moving on to the next point. So we talked about that there is a literary relationship, and the next point is Mark was almost certainly the first, and that's known as Markan priority. Mark was the first one to write a gospel. So while there are some who disagree, the overwhelming majority of scholars today agree that Mark was the first of the three synoptic gospels to be written, and there's really good reason for this. Sometimes you have overwhelming agreement, and when you dig into it, you find there's not really a lot of reason why there's this overwhelming agreement. Everyone's just repeating each other. Other times, a lot of the time, overwhelming agreement is overwhelming agreement because the evidence for that position is as overwhelming as the agreement is, and I think that's the case here. So to begin with, even though Mark is a much shorter book, so Mark is the shortest of the four Gospels, when you actually get down into the textual details of the stories that Mark tells and the stories that Matthew and Luke tell, you'll find that Mark almost very normally, usually, uses more words to tell a given story than either Matthew or Luke does. So Matthew or Luke have a lot more stories and a lot more teaching, but Mark is actually wordier. Now, it doesn't make very good sense to see Mark as an abridgment of Matthew and Luke. So if we understand, say, Mark took Matthew and Luke and he gave just the essentials as briefly as possible, then he didn't do a very good job of it if that's what he was trying to do. And so it just doesn't make very much sense to say that. At the same time, it includes very, very little that isn't also in Matthew or Luke. So there's very little in Mark that isn't also found in Matthew or Luke. So if you want to say, well, Mark was wanting to expand Matthew or Luke, well, he didn't expand it. So it doesn't make real sense to see it as an abridgment, and it certainly doesn't make sense to see it as an expansion. So that's from the negative side. Second, and more positively, viewing things the other way around does make a good deal of sense. The strong testimony of the early church is that the gospel according to Mark provides us with the testimony of Peter. It provides us with a written record of the way that Peter presented the gospel in his oral preaching. And in fact, there's some fascinating parallels between the outline of the gospel of Mark and the outline of the gospel that we find in Peter's preaching in Acts. And yet, while Mark provides a punchy summary of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, it provides very little of the teaching of Jesus. So you have a few parables, you have some teaching, but Mark is mostly just action, stories, miracles, dialogues, back and forth. There's very little blocks of teaching in Mark's gospel. And that's something that both Matthew and Luke, each in their own way, provide quite a bit of. While each of them is built around the same basic outline provided by Mark. So remember I said the Synoptic Gospels have their own outline, and John has his own outline. So they have sort of the same outline. Matthew, Mark, and Luke share a similar outline. Both of them, while sometimes abbreviating the material already provided in Mark, provide a great deal of additional material that Mark doesn't include. And so when this is kept in mind, seeing Matthew and Luke as subsequent expansions to Mark's outline of Peter's proclamation of the gospel makes a lot of sense. It just fits with what we actually find in the gospels. And it makes sense both from looking at the textual data and from looking theologically. What's going on? Why would God do this? It just seems to fit very well. So it's not the sort of thing we'd want to stake our salvation on, but it seems pretty substantially evidenced. And there are many more technical arguments that come to the same conclusion, all of which I will spare you, given the amount of ground that we're covering tonight. But it's probably best that we move on. So to summarize, we have the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we have the Gospel of John. There is almost certainly a literary relationship between the three synoptic gospels, and there is very likely that Mark was the first of those three gospels. So I'm moving from what is most certain to what is more debated. So what is most certain is that the three synoptics stand on their own and John is a little bit different. So that is maximally certain. And then that there is a literary relationship between the three gospels. That is, I think, very likely as well. And then that Mark was the first. Now we're going to get to what is a lot more debated, but that turns out to be relevant for how we understand Matthew. So the more difficult question, one on which there's been a great deal of debate and which coming to conclusions is much harder, is how Matthew and Luke are related. And so without taking the time to go into all the arguments pro and con, I'll just give you a brief sketch of the view that I've come to over the years. So this is my perspective, and there are other perspectives that could be given. And so we talked about Mark and priority. Mark wrote first. That's pretty widely held. I think there's a very strong case that can be made for that. And Matthew knew and used Mark. So it's pretty clear Matthew's writing with Mark in view. And because of this, as we seek to understand the particular points that the Spirit inspired Matthew to make, it's frequently helpful to closely compare Matthew to Mark and see the differences between the two. So Matthew had Mark, and Matthew is giving a perspective that's building on Mark's perspective. So when you see the things that he added and you look at the way the two texts are compared, it helps you to have a clear sense of the point that Matthew was inspired to make. I think Luke knew and used Matthew and Mark. This is the point that there have been, I have read personally thousands of pages debating this particular point, and there's tens of thousands of pages that have been written that I haven't read, but I think after reading all of those pages that Luke knew and used Matthew and Mark. So I think Mark came first, then came Matthew, then came Luke. Luke writes with Matthew and Mark in mind. And I think John knew Mark and likely knew Matthew or Luke or both. Potentially, he knew all three of the Synoptic Gospels, but he chose to supplement rather than to expand them. So it's a basically a different way of writing his gospel that Matthew sat down to basically expand and rework Mark like the writers of Chronicles expanded and reworked, well, didn't expand, but they reworked the material you find in Samuel and Kings. That's how the Synoptic Gospels worked. And then Luke worked off the same basic outline again, and John decided to complement. So if you look at, if you compare John to the Synoptics, you'll find John, like almost all of John, fits into the gaps left by the Synoptics. So John is filling in the details that none of the Synoptics had presented. So it sort of fits in like pieces of the puzzle. And it's really quite fascinating to work through that. So we talked about writing. Obviously, this is a very quick overview. But any questions about writing the fourfold gospel, how the gospels are related? Over here, here. No questions. So either we're being very clear or very confusing. So hopefully it's clear. So it's all well and good to talk about the way the four Gospels are related to each other, but this still doesn't answer the question as to why we have no less than four Gospels, with all the challenges that a fourfold Gospel brings, and why we have no more than four Gospels, despite the claims of those who would wish to multiply the number of Gospels that we can go to learn about Jesus. So it's these questions we now turn as we discuss preserving the fourfold gospel. So we talked about writing the fourfold gospel. Now we're going to talk about preserving the fourfold gospel. Throughout the early church's struggle with paganism, the differences between the four gospels were a consistent source of attack. Pagan skeptics in the second century AD were already raising some of the same challenges that Muslim skeptics and others continue to raise in our own day. If they wanted to know, this is the skeptic speaking, not me, there is only one true gospel, why are there no less than four gospels, each of which tells the story using different words, each from its own unique perspective, perspectives that are sometimes difficult for us to fit together? If they demanded the Gospels were really from God, would not one expect all of them to fit together perfectly without any difficulty or ambiguity or unanswered questions? Isn't that what you would expect? And even apart from pagan challenges, this was something that many professing Christians wrestled with on their own account, even as many continue to wrestle with it in our own day. And to give just one example of the sort of challenges that the early church was facing, around the third quarter of the second century, this is second century AD, this is very, very early, the pagan and Platonic philosopher Celsus wrote an attack on Christianity, and it's the oldest literary attack on Christianity of which the details have survived. And Celsus's work actually didn't survive, but one of the early church writers wrote a detailed rebuttal to Celsus that preserved most of the points that Celsus made. And so he gave so many quotes that scholars are able to reconstruct the point of view that Celsus had. And having read at least a couple of the Gospels, Celsus made considerable use of the differences between them in his all-out attack on the reliability of the Christian message. And from his point of view, from the point of view of Celsus, rather than four Gospels being a source of strength to the Christians, it was an embarrassment. It was something they should be ashamed of, and he raised a lot of challenges about the fourfold Gospel. And there are three basic ways that professing Christians in the second century responded to this challenge to the fourfold Gospel. Not all of these are, of course, direct responses to Celsus. Some of these three individuals we'll talk about actually lived and worked before Celsus, but they were all ways of responding to the challenges that he and others were raising. So we have four Gospels, and we have pagans and others that are challenging. Why do we have these four Gospels? Why are there differences between the four Gospels? Why, you Christians are confused, you can't make up your mind. Why do you have four Gospels? This makes no sense to me. So there's people raising these challenges. And we have one solution, not a good solution, solution falsely so called, was advocated by a man named Marcion. Marcion, the first great heretic that we know about. Now, great is in bad, not good. But Marcion's heresy hasn't gone away. So he was excommunicated from the church at Rome in AD 144. This is early church history. And Marcion went on to found his own group of churches that were all over the Roman Empire. Marcionism was one of the first great challenges the early church faced in terms of warding off false teaching. And so what Marcion did is he, first of all, he got rid of the Old Testament. So he only had the New Testament. And he got rid of all the Gospels but one. So he didn't like that there were four Gospels. And he didn't like that the Gospels had a lot of stuff that said good things about Jewish people. And it's really interesting how Paul talks about how some of the Gentiles were tempted to reject the Jews. Well, less than 100 years after Paul sends Romans, there is a significant group in the Roman church that wanted to get rid of the Old Testament completely. So this was something Paul saw coming, and he was addressing this tendency that was already present. And so Marcion kept the Gospel of Luke only, and he got rid of all the things that made the Old Testament sound good in Luke. So he had one Gospel, and then he had a small selection of letters, so he had a very pared-down canon of Scripture. And rather than dealing with the four different Gospels, the fourfold Gospels, Marcion went down to one, according to him, purified gospel that had, or so he claimed, no difficulties. And of course, Marcion had other concerns than gospel plurality, but the desire to have one unified message with no tensions and no difficulties, one that avoided the connection to the Judaism that was so despised by the Romans, was certainly a part of Marcion's agenda. And so throughout the early church, avoiding the radical reductionism of Marcion was to become a rallying cry for the importance of preserving the fourfold gospel. So Marcion, so the pagan challenge is raised, and Marcion's move is, let's just reduce down to one gospel, and that will make things easier. Well, there was, obviously, the church rejected Marcion and got rid of him and his heresies. And it was really a long-term battle, a struggle. And we've even had some prominent Christian leaders in our own day calling for the church to unhitch itself from the Old Testament. And so if you hear, in response to that controversy, accusations of Marcionism, that's what this goes back to, because this really has been a persistent temptation into the Christian church. And so while Marcion wanted to get rid of all the Gospels except for one, there's a man named Tatian who takes a different approach. So Tatian was also troubled that there were four different Gospels. And so what he did is he merged all four Gospels into one super Gospel. And it was called the Diatessaron. And so he harmonized all the Gospels into one unified Gospel that had one smooth narrative, that had all the details, and all the duplicates were taken out, and all the tensions of different accounts were removed, and Tatian presumably felt like he had solved the problem. Now, the problem wasn't that Tatian produced a gospel harmony, but the problem was that Tatian's harmony was being read in church in place of the four gospels. So there's nothing wrong with, you know, producing a gospel harmony, but if you replace the four gospels with a single gospel harmony, you're synthesizing it all together. You're replacing what God gave the church with something that you gave the church, and that is a problem. So we have Marcionite reductionism, and then we have Tatian's synthesis, and Tatian also was rejected. His approach was rejected by the early church as well. So he's also in the second century. And I won't go down that rabbit trail. So we have a reduction, we have synthesis, and then we have preservation. And the early church as a whole rejected these proposed solutions, a quote unquote, to the challenges raised by Celsus and other pagan opponents. They recognized that God had given four gospels to the church, no more and no less, each of which had its own unique and essential portrait of Christ, portrait and picture of who Jesus was and is that we needed. As the second century church father Irenaeus rather famously put it, well, famously in the circles that talk about second century reception of the gospels, potentially not famous as in, like, you know, on TV or anything like that. So Irenaeus said this: "It is not possible that the Gospels can be either more or fewer in number than they are. For since there are four zones of the world in which we live, and four principal winds, while the church is scattered throughout all the world, and the pillar and ground of the church is the gospel and the spirit of life, it is fitting that she should have four pillars, breathing out immortality on every side, and vivifying or making alive men afresh. From which fact it is evident that the Word, the artificer or the maker of all, he that sitteth upon the cherubim and contains all things, he who is manifested to men has given us the gospel under four aspects, but bound together by one spirit, one fourfold gospel. And time fails to read the entirety of Irenaeus' discussion because he goes on and on and on about this. It's something he's very, very passionate about. He goes on to compare the Gospels in detail to the four living creatures described in Ezekiel and Revelation. And so this was the image of all the images that Irenaeus used. It's the one that really gets picked up on because countless Gospels would have pictures of the four evangelists, and they would be paralleled with the four beasts that you find. So you have like one with a face like a man, one with a face like an ox, one with a face like an eagle, and one with a face like a lion. So there's a few different ways those images get aligned, but one of the common ways is Matthew is the face of a man because he starts with a genealogy, and Mark starts with a roar of action. So Mark is the lion. And Luke is a sacrificial ox because it starts with Zacharias in the temple. And then John is the soaring eagle that soars to before the beginning of time to tell about the Logos. And so you'll find the evangelist, you'll find these sort of pictures at the front of different Gospels. And it was the way that Christians thought about it. Ephraim, one of my favorite parallels, and this may not be very persuasive, but Ephraim, who is a Syrian church father, went so far as to compare the four Gospels to the four rivers that divide out of the single spring in Eden. So there's a single spring in Eden in Genesis, and it divides into four rivers, and he uses that as an analogy for the singular gospel that is then conveyed to the church through the four rivers of the four Gospels. And so you have this strong emphasis, and some of the imagery may seem fanciful to us, but the point was that there's an appropriateness to there being a fourfold gospel, each of which conveys the same Christ, the same gospel, but four different human writers, the gospel according to these four different writers. And there's four gospels, no more and no less. And perhaps in order to counter the temptation that some had to reduce the number of gospels, the 4th century Greek church father Eusebius devised a way to lock the four gospels together. So Eusebius used tables with columns, known as the Eusebian canons or the Eusebian apparatus, to enable cross-references between the gospels. So he had these columns, and they would be at the beginning of the Gospels. So in his first canon, his first table, he listed all the passages that are found in all four Gospels. There's not very many of those because John's outline is so different from the Synoptics. But Eusebius's first set of tables had all the places you could see all the places that appeared in all four Gospels. In the second, third, and fourth, he gave different combinations of things that appeared in three Gospels. So everything that appeared in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, everything that appeared in the different combinations, and so forth and so on to the 10th table, which provides the places that are unique to each Gospel. And then he had these tables at the beginning, and then there were cross-reference numbers throughout the Gospels. So the Gospels were divided into sections. And so when you came to a particular section in Matthew, what you could do is that would tell you what the section number was in Matthew, and then it would tell you what the table was. So is this something that appears in all four Gospels? Is it something that's unique to Matthew? Is it something that is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, such forth and so on? And so what this did, it was... So what's really fascinating about this is it is the first system of cross-references ever devised for the Gospels or for any other text. It's the very first system of cross-references. And Eusebius's canon tables were astonishingly successful. So to quote actually someone I know personally, while it originally originated in Greek, the apparatus accompanied the Gospels into many other languages, Latin, Gothic, Syriac, Ethiopic, Armenian, Georgian, Slavonic, Coptic, Arabic, even Caucasian, Albanian. For well over a millennium, the vast majority of people who encountered a gospel manuscript did so in a form that was shaped by the Eusebian apparatus. So this may seem like something that's sort of like arcane and unusual to us, but for over 1,000 years, everyone who read the Gospels in the light of the Eusebian apparatus. I shouldn't say everyone, but almost everyone, because this is present in almost every manuscript of the Gospels that we have, in almost every language that we know about. This Eusebian apparatus tied the four Gospels together, and what Eusebius did is he placed priority on reading each Gospel in its own right. So unlike Marcion, he didn't get rid of any of the Gospels. Unlike Tatian, he didn't rearrange the order of the Gospels into an order that he thought was more appropriate. He kept each Gospel in the order in which it was written, but he enabled comparison between the four Gospels, and so he exemplified, I think, how we ought to read the four Gospels, and we'll return to this matter of reading the fourfold Gospel here in a few moments. So what we can learn about how to read the Gospel, we'll talk about that in the conclusion. But before we do that, we need to talk about no more than four. So the church faced a temptation to have less than four Gospels, but there was also a temptation to have more than four Gospels. While ancient pagan opponents and some modern-day skeptics often wonder why we have four Gospels instead of just one, others want to expand the number of Gospels that we have. Indeed, if you listen to some presentations, you'd think there are dozens and dozens of Gospels, all of which are roughly similar to the four that we have, and many of which present radically different views of Jesus. Especially if you watch National Geographic or read Time Magazine or something like that, you'll think there's lots and lots of Gospels out there. On this viewpoint, from this perspective, which is false, the church more or less randomly picked four out of any number of equally viable candidates. And yet, though this is very common, especially in the secular world, it's almost entirely wrong. For while there are indeed many texts that modern-day scholars have decided to label Gospels, it's a mistake to think of these in the same category as the four that we have. So all these so-called Gospels that we have, other than the four, fit into one or two categories. Number one, there are fragments that we know almost nothing about, that are sometimes only a couple of lines. So how many of you saw the news story about the gospel of Jesus' wife a few years back? It was a major, Pastor John, you saw it. It was a major news story. Well, it turns out it was called a gospel, but it was only a couple lines in Coptic, in ancient Egyptian language. And it further turns out that those lines were a forgery. It was a tiny fragment of forged papyrus. And there are other fragments like that that are not forged. There's many fragments. And if it is a fragment of something that sounds like it's talking about Jesus, then people will label it a gospel and write long books about it. But a tiny fragment cannot be set in comparison to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So we have fragments that we don't know anything about, and people can speculate, but they're speculating. And then we have other things that may be labeled a gospel, but are very clearly dependent on one or more of the four Gospels that we already have. So they're derivative texts. Some of these texts are relatively orthodox texts, that seek to fill in the gaps left by the canonical Gospels. So the four Gospels that God gave us don't say anything about Jesus' childhood. So there were lots of people who wrote stories about what they think took place in Jesus' childhood. And they weren't necessarily trying to replace the four Gospels, but they were trying to fill in the gaps. And so there's a lot of things like that. Or people wanted to know more details about the details of how Jesus was born. So you have a whole collection of works that try to give you the hidden scoop of that. But it's not a whole gospel that tells the story of Jesus' message and Jesus' ministry. It's just someone's ideas about what the Gospels didn't talk about. And almost without exception, all of these betray their dependence on the canonical Gospels. They're not an alternative to them. They're a later person's idea that has no more authority than a modern-day novelist idea of what took place in Jesus' day. And others of them, while they're labeled by modern scholars Gospels, are actually attempts to bring together various gospel material for a particular purpose. So perhaps gathering all the materials on the death of Jesus together for teaching purposes, even as we might do today in a commentary or a sermon. And then still others of them are the attempts of Gnostics or other heretics to impose their own viewpoints on Jesus and the other characters from the Gospels. So they're taking the names of the apostles and they're saying things that are completely foreign to anything that a first century Jew would actually have said. So there's some very strange texts out there, but they're not another text like Matthew, Mark, and Luke that just didn't get picked by the church. You'll sometimes hear people say that. None of these texts offer the sort of blend of extended narrative with interwoven teaching that we find in the fourfold gospel. And so all of them that are long enough to be examined for such things give evidence of literary dependence on the canonical fourfold gospel. So we talked about writing the fourfold gospel, and we talked about preserving the fourfold gospel, and it's time now to move to reading the fourfold gospel. As we've already noted, each of the Gospels present four different pictures of one Jesus. Each of these pictures is unique in ways that are large and small. In some ways, this is like having four different photographs from different perspectives of a single individual. One writer tells of visiting Chartwell, the country home of Winston Churchill, which is now a museum. And on the wall of Churchill's home, his country estate, there are many portraits and pictures of Churchill, each of which captures a different elements of his expansive personality and seemingly boundless interest. So there are pictures of Churchill as a ruler, as a leader of the British people. There are pictures of him sort of, you know, in uniform with the soldiers. There are pictures of him painting and relaxing at his country home. There are lots of different pictures that give lots of different perspectives on Churchill. And April's smiling because I think you really like reading about Churchill. So you've told me about that. And something very similar is true about the Gospels. The Gospels were never intended to be blow-by-blow chronological accounts of the ministry of Jesus that answer every question that we might have that would somehow correspond to if we had a video camera on the scene and we recorded everything that happened, we could coordinate that exactly with the way the Gospel is structured. That's just not the way that they work. That was never their intention. They are instead theological biographies that have each been shaped by the Spirit to give us a unique picture of who Christ is that we would not have without that gospel. As we will see in more detail when we dig into the structure of Matthew next week, the shape of each of the gospels is not primarily determined by the details of chronology, but rather by their Spirit-inspired theological perspective and divinely guided literary technique. So if you actually get into what Matthew is doing, especially if you compare Matthew with Mark, you'll find that much of Matthew is arranged not chronologically, but thematically. That Matthew has put together the teachings of Jesus and has organized them into specific groupings on specific topics to enable you to see a Jesus as a teacher in a new way, a way that you wouldn't have been able to see if you only had the Gospel of Mark. And so Matthew is giving us a perspective on the same Jesus that we wouldn't have if we didn't have Matthew. And while there is a value in comparing the pictures that the Gospels present, they are, after all, pictures of the same Jesus, we are not well served by trying to combine them all into one super picture, which destroys their uniqueness and replaces it with a reconstruction of our own invention. Ultimately, the task of understanding is best served by focusing our efforts on understanding what each of these pictures has to teach us in its own right. And we need to always remember it's the Gospels in the shape that we have them that are inspired, not our own attempts to get behind that shaping. The shaping and arrangement of the individual teachings and the stories in the Gospels does not obscure the truth of what really happened, but it rather draws out some particular aspect of its significance, the particular aspect that God wanted us to have. And when it comes to reading the fourfold gospel, it's helpful to think of reading horizontally, comparing the gospel accounts, and reading vertically, reading each gospel account in its own right. So two different perspectives. And so reading horizontally means lining the four gospels up or following the chain of cross-references and seeing how the four gospels each present the same story or the same teaching and looking at what is unique about each of the four gospels in that way. So this is something that we can learn from. However, we need to avoid the temptation to place our faith not in the gospels as they were given to us, but on our own reconstruction of what we think really happened. So, for instance, it's profitable. The feeding of the 5,000 is one of the few stories that's in all four gospels. And the feeding of the 5,000 is told from slightly different perspectives in each of the four gospels. And the temptation we could have is to merge all the details together into one super story of what really happened. The problem is, we're not always going to get it right. God is always right. Each of the four gospels is a reliable account. But our ability to merge that together and produce one super story of the feeding of the 5,000 is not infallible or inspired. And while we must always, and our reconstruction is not what God has given us, what God has given us is four different stories, each of which reveals something about who Jesus was and is, and it's that something that each gospel reveals about who Jesus was and is that our faith should be placed in. And while we must always insist in principle the fourfold gospel does not ever contradict itself, we must also recognize that because of the limitations of our understanding, there'll always be questions that we can't answer and tensions we can't resolve. And that is perfectly all right because God is smarter than we are and he doesn't owe us a perfect explanation of everything. And throughout history, some believers, rather than being satisfied with what God has given us, have resorted to rather forced explanations that distorted what God has given us. Four glorious lenses through which to be confronted with the lordship and the majesty of Jesus Christ in order to produce what God has not given us, a single historical account that removes each and every point we might feel to be a point of tension from our own perspective. To give a few particularly egregious examples from this tendency, because he wasn't comfortable with the different perspectives the gospel writers give on the threefold denial of Peter, the 20th century American writer Harold Lindzell insisted, in order to get all the details to line up to his satisfaction, he decided Peter must have denied Jesus five times. Because he couldn't get the accounts of the three denials to line up in a way that made sense to him, then he concluded Peter must have denied Jesus five times. This isn't a 20th century problem, because the 16th century German theologian insisted that Jesus must have cleansed the temple no less than three times. So he couldn't reconcile the accounts to his satisfaction, and so he came up with three cleansings of the temple. This is not, as I hope should be clear by now, the path down which we want to go. While we should seek to read the gospel side by side, and while it's appropriate to explore how they fit together, our faith must always be in what the gospels actually say and the sequence of each individual account, not in our own reconstruction of what we think really happened. And though there is a great benefit in reading horizontally and comparing the four gospels, and we'll do a little bit of that in our study of Matthew, the priority must always be on reading vertically. So reading vertically is you're reading down the page of the gospel, you're reading in the sequence that each gospel was written, and you're focusing on the point that each gospel is making. On hearing the testimony of each gospel writer to the Jesus in whom they each call us to place all our faith and trust. Like Eusebius, we read horizontally. When we compare the four Gospels, we do that not to get behind the fourfold Gospel, not to replace it with some new construct of our own imagination, but rather to preserve, to understand, to bind the fourfold Gospel together, not... As one set of writers put it, interpretation and application of a given passage in the Gospels should stress the particular emphasis of the gospel in which the passage occurs, rather than blurring its distinctives by immediately combining it with other parallels. God chose to inspire not a harmony of the gospels, but four distinct ones, and we should respect his choice rather than undermine it by our interpretation. Thinking vertically, therefore, should take priority over thinking horizontally. By this we mean that any passage in the Gospels should primarily be interpreted in light of the overall structure and themes of that Gospel. So we talked about writing the fourfold Gospel, we talked about preserving the fourfold Gospel, and we talked about reading the fourfold Gospel, reading horizontally and reading vertically. And the four Gospels present us four facets of one diamond, four lenses that are looking at the same person. Our goal must always be to see Jesus as we read the Gospels. And what we must always remember is that it is only to the degree that we see the glory of Christ through the lens that each Gospel writer was inspired to show Christ that we are reading the Gospels as God intended us to do. And no matter how much you know about the way that the Gospels were written, no matter how learnedly you can discuss their various features, if your learning does not lead you to see the glory of Christ through the fourfold lens of the Gospels with greater intensity and clarity, then you have wasted your time. Any final questions before we conclude? Noah? Nate? It wouldn't so much be filling in gaps, but see what Matthew added in particular. So just comparing them helps you see the way that Matthew was working, and seeing the way that Matthew was working helps you to understand the point he was trying to make better. As to why the Gospels are ordered Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's a really complicated topic that we don't have time to get into tonight. But So I can tell you that afterwards, and anyone else who wants to know can come talk with us, but we'll be here for 20 minutes if I try to explain that. And I'm sure Noah wouldn't like that. Anyone else before we wrap up? All right, let's go ahead and pray and be done. Father, I come before you. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Gospels, talk about the Gospel of Matthew, and I just pray, Father, Lord, that as we start to dig into some of the preparatory stuff for this series, that you would bless it and give understanding and clarity, give wisdom to know what to cover and what not to cover. And I pray, Father, Lord, that you would be glorified in all we do say and think. Be with us as we go to our respective homes. Help us to glorify you. In Jesus' name, amen.